Greetings and welcome back to our weekly Parshat HaShavua podcast. My name is Yitzchak Etshalom. And this week, Parshat Vayigash is filled with all sorts of dramatic things, many of which are either conclusive in nature, the concluding piece of the story of Yosef and his brothers finally being reunited, Yosef revealing himself. That's something that I sent out in a written version. Also, the seeds of future slavery seem to be set in the very long piece that the Torah devotes to the economic status of the Egyptians towards the end of our parsha, and that's something that we will talk about in a couple of weeks in Parashat Shmot. However, for right now, I'd like to look at something which seems fairly mundane and trivial, which is Breshit Perek Memvav, Pasuk Chet through Chav Zayin, which is the list of Bnei Yisrael who came down to Egypt, sort of the official list of the emigres who came down at Yosef's behest. I'll read. Ve'elashmot Bnei Yisrael Abayim Mitzrayim Yaakov Uvanav Bechor Yaakov Reuven. So the first thing to point out is that Reuven is still considered the Bechor. Please take a look when you have a chance at Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Perakei Pasuk Aleph, to see how that's dealt with. Uvnei Reuven Chanoch Ufanu Chetzon Recharmi. So we're told who Reuven's sons are. And the clear assumption here is that Reuven's sons came down with him, meaning that they were already alive at the time, and that's certainly reasonable, considering that Reuven was in his, shall we say, in his 40s or maybe in his 50s at the time. Uvnei Shimon Yumuel V'Yamin V'Oad V'Yachin V'Tzocha V'Sha'ul Ben Akananit. So we find out Shimon's sons. Uvnei Levi Gershon Kehatum Rari. Fine. Uvnei Yehuda, and now we're given a little bit of a window into the past. Er V'Onan, but Er V'Onan, as we know, already died, and we're going to be told about that here. V'Sheila V'Aferetz V'Zarach. So Yehuda has five sons, but not really. V'Yamot Er V'Onan Be'eretz Kanan V'Yuvnei Feretz Chetzron V'Chamul. And therein lies the riddle, as we'll get to in a couple of minutes. So Bnei Yehuda are these five, but we're told that Aaron Onan died in Eretz Canaan. Now this is a little misleading. In other words, we're not given the full information, but we know the full information from Perek Lamed Chet, and that is that Aaron Onan and Shelah were Yehuda's family. Aaron Onan died, and Zerach and Peretz, or Peretz and Zerach properly, seem to come in sort of as a substitution for them when Tamar disguises herself, and of course the rest is Jewish history. We will get back, though, to the mention of Chetzron and Chamul, which is really the key to the riddle. Uvnei Yisachar, Tola Ufuva, V'yov, V'shimron, Uvnei Zvulun, Sered, V'ilon, V'yachle'el, Eile B'nei Lea, Sheyudali Yaakov, V'fadan Aram, Sheyudali Yaakov, V'fadan Aram. So these are Leah's sons. Now there's something tricky here. The sons that gave birth, that she birthed to Yaakov in Padan Aram, and of course all of Leah's sons were born in Padan Aram, V'yet Dina Vito, and Dina also. Kol Nefesh Uvanav Notav Shloshim V'Shalosh. Now, who is counted here? Leah's not counted. Of course, we have to assume, based on Yaakov's later statement, that Leah's already dead. We do not find that any of the wives of Reuven, Shimon, etc. are mentioned here. We find only that Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, and Dina, plus the boys' sons, are counted. We're not told whether or not there are daughters in the mix, shall we say granddaughters. We're told that the sum total is 33. So far, so good. Uvnei Gad, Tzifion v'Chagi, Shoni v'Etzbon, Eriv, Arodi v'Areli. So you have Gad plus his seven sons. Uvnei Asher, Yimna v'Yishva v'Yishvi uvriya v'Serach Achotam. So Asher and his five children, for some reason Serach gets recognition here. Uvnei Vriya, Chevra Malkiel. And now we find out that Bria already had children, Chever Malkiel. And notice that Leah's handmaid has nearly half the size of the family, has Leah 33 plus 16. Keep a running tab, that's 49. Bnei Rachel, Eshet Yaakov, Yosef Binyamin. Now that mention of Eshet Yaakov is something that is very prominent in Yehuda's speech to Yosef, but that's something, again, I dealt with in the written internet piece that I sent out this week. Now, Vayivaled Yosef Peretz Yisrael Asher Yilda Lo Asnat Bat Potifera Kohen On Et Menashe Bet Ephraim. So Yosef has two kids. Uvnei Binyamin, Bela Vavecher V'Ashbel, Geira V'Naman, Echi V'Rosh, Vupim V'Chupim V'Ard, that's 11. Uvnei Ra'ela B'nei Rachel, Sheyulad Li'akov, Kol Nefesh Arba Asar, so that's 14. It's 14 because there's Binyamin and his 10 sons, that's 11, plus Yosef and his two sons, that's 14. Uvnei Dan Chushim, our famous thing, Sefer Torah shel Rabbi Meir, kai katuv uven dan chushim, vnei dan chushim, uvnei naftali achzel, v'gunim v'yetzer v'shilem. So it's a total of Dan plus one son, Naftali plus four sons is seven. Eile vnei vilha shenatan lefan l'rachel b'tov etel edli Yaakov kol nefesh shiva. So do the math. You've got seven plus 14. And again, the mother has exactly twice as much as the handmaid. Seven plus 14 is 21. And then earlier we had 33 plus 16 is 49. 21 and 49, bingo, is 70. That's perfect. Kol nefesh ba'ali Yaakov Mitzrayim ha'yotzei rechom v'aneshev ne Yaakov kol nefesh shishim v'ashesh. And so there were 66 who came down. Now that's a little bit odd, because we know that Yosef, Ephraim, and Manasseh are in Mitzrayim, which means if you have a total of 70 minus 3, you should have 67. When Yosef is allowed in Mitzrayim, nefesh shnayim, kol nefesh levet Yaakov ba Mitzrayim ha'shivim. So somewhere there's a gap in there. And famously, the Midrash deals with it and maintains that if you count Leah's family, you will find that there's really only 32 in the family. And let's go back and take a look. We have Reuven plus Chanoch, Palu, Chatzon, and Karmi. That's five. You have Shimon plus Yimuel, V'Yamin, V'Yahad, V'Yachin, V'Tzochar, and Shaul. So that's seven. So that's 12. Nelevi, Gershon, Karmi, V'Yamin, that makes 16. And Yehuda is Yehuda plus his three sons that are alive. So that's 20. Plus Chetzron and Chamul, that's 22. Yisachar plus four sons is 27. Zvulun and three sons is 31. Right? So, and there was an extra one there in the case of Shimon, so 32, and nonetheless it says 33. So Chazal famously say that the missing person here is, this is one of the Midrashim, is Yocheved. That Yocheved was born on the way into Egypt, so there weren't 33 of Leah's family that really left. Or shall we say in the penultimate pasuk of this parsha, kol ha-nefesh ha-ba'al Yaakov, the people who were coming, and here is where the stress is important, the stress on the word ha-ba'a, which were coming, were 66. There were 66 that were coming down. But at the end of the parsha, kol ha-nefesh ha-ba'al Yaakov ha-ba'a Mitzrayim, that came, that's in the past tense, were really 70. In other words, 66 left, there's three in Mitzrayim, and one is born on the way, that's 70, that's perfect. Except for one point that Ibn Ezra raises is the whole issue of the age of Yocheved, etc. But there's another point here, which is that if you look carefully at the psukim, you'll notice that the entire counting of the family here is Yotzei Yerech Yaakov, meaning the children born of Yaakov. And Ibn Ezra famously maintains that the 70th is Yaakov himself, because if you count, look at the last pasuk, it says, Kol nefesh livet Yaakov, all the people in Beit Yaakov is 70. That's the 69 of his children, grandchildren, and in a couple of cases, great-grandchildren, and Yaakov himself. All right, be that as it may, that's not the main thing I'd like to focus on. I'd like to turn our attention back to Pasuk Yod Bet, which is the counting of Bnei Yehuda. And here is the problem. If we go back to Perek Lamed Chet, chapter 38, it says, Vayered Yehuda Me'etachav, Yehuda left his brothers. And reading the sequence of the events, as it's presented in the Torah, the Midrash picks up and says, Vayered Yehuda, that Yehuda went down from his brothers because his brothers were angry at him for the sale of Yosef. Whether he engineered the sale of Yosef or he suggested it and they weren't successful, the famous dispute with the Rashbam and everybody else about whether the brothers actually did sell him. Nonetheless, Yehuda was the one who was held responsible by the brothers. And as a result, they sort of distanced themselves from him and he left and started his own life. Okay, but that means the following. That means that from the point that Yosef is sold, which at the very earliest was when he was 17, because we are introduced to Yosef at the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev, at the age of 17, told about the enmity between him and his brothers. We are told about the dreams. Immediately afterwards, we're told about his fateful mission to go find his brothers in Dothan, and ultimately his sale to the Ishmaelim, and sold down to Potiphar in Egypt. So at the very, very earliest in his life, he could have been 17. We are also told that when Yosef stood before Paro to interpret his dreams, he was 30. which means there's a gap of at the very most 13 years. Of course, Yosef might have been 19 or 20 when he was sold, because we're not told how much time passed between the introduction of Yosef and his dreams and going to Shechem. But even if we assume it all happened at the same time, one after the other, at the very, very youngest, Yosef is 17, which means the most time that could have passed between Yosef being sold and Yosef interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, which Yosef himself said are going to come immediately. Ki nachon hadavar me'im ha'elohim u'maher Elohim la'asoto. The most amount of time you can allot there is 13 years. Add 7 years of plenty. So that means that Yosef now, at the very most, is 20 years since he's been separated from his family. And then, a couple of years later, evidently in the second year of the famine, is when the family is reunited after they come down a second time and then leave the city and are brought back. And then he reveals himself to them at the beginning of Vayigash in that very emotional passage. And then the brothers go up and bring Yaakov down. Very nice. So at the very, very most that we could have here, the very most would be 22 years. And the Midrash picks up on the idea of 22 years. And the Midrash says that Yaakov was punished. There's the Midrash at the end of the first chapter of Masechet Megillah, that Yaakov was punished for the 22 years that he did not, fulfill the mitzvah of Kibud Av by staying with Yitzchak when Esav was there and he went off to Lavan, even though that's what he needed to do. For those 22 years, he was punished in kind by having his own son gone from him for 22 years. All right, so 22 years, we'll work with that. Now, if we read through Parshat Vayeshev, we have the events of Yosef culminating at the end of Perek Lamed Zayin in his sale, and the very next piece is chapter 38, which is Yehuda going to Timnah and starting up his own life, which again, if read chronologically in sequence, happens after he left his brothers because he no longer was welcome there or because he was disgraced or for whatever reason, starts his own life, what does he do? Now remember, all of this happens within the span of 22 years, according to the greatest estimate that we can give. He marries, has two children, Er and Onan, and then a little while later has Shelah. Shelah is not born immediately later, as you can see from the beginning of Perek Lamed Chet, that first he marries a girl, and we could assume he marries the girl the first day he gets there, if we want to. And he has Er, so that's 1 year. He has Onan, that is another year. And then we'll call it, even to be very conservative, 2 more years until Shelah is born, because we know that after Onan dies, Shelah is still too young to do Yibum on Tamar, and so he says, wait until Shelah grows up, and then he'll do Yibum, which of course he doesn't intend to do, so we'll give Shelah 2 years. That means he's already been there for 4 years. 4 years out of the 22. Now, at that point, Er has to grow up and be old enough to marry Tamar, which at the very earliest we're going to give him 13. But even if we want to give him younger than that, say he was 10 years old when he married, which is an extremely extravagant proposal, but let's say that that's the case, that means that he's already been there for 11 years. And let's say Er is 10, and Onan is 9, and Shelah is 7. Let's even say that. Er is punished by God. And even if we want to assume that Er is so bad that even at the age of 10, God holds him culpable and punishes him, something which contradicts everything that we know about free will and about knowledge and about awareness and about culpability and liability before God, even if we want to assume that's the case, then that means that it's got to be at least another year until Onan becomes of age to do Yibum. All right, so let's say that we're now in year 12 since Yehuda's arrived, and in the meantime, he's got Er, he's got Onan, Er has married Tamar, Shelah was already born, Er has married Tamar, Er died because he was bad, Onan refused to do proper Yibum because he was bad, he then sends Tamar away and says, let's wait until Shelah grows up and then he'll marry you, and it doesn't happen. And what happens? She's there for a long time, Vayirbu Hayamim. Long enough that she sees Shelah grows up and she's not given to him. Shelah has to be at least 13 at this point in order for her to see that he's old enough to marry and she's not been married to him. Which means that Yehuda has been there for, shall we say, 16, 17 years. Okay? Good. And then he meets Tamar, and then, as we all know, within 9 months, she gives birth to twins, and those twins are Peretz and Zerach. So at the very, very most that we could, the very smallest amount, the lowest number that we could estimate, is that within approximately 18 years of Yehuda arriving in Timnah, Zerach and Peretz are born. Zerach and Peretz are born, And the text tells us that their sons came down to Mitzrayim. Well, how old could Zerach and Peretz have been? How old could Peretz have been when he married and had sons that came down with him to Egypt? 3 years old? 4 years old? So we have one of two choices here. The one choice is to read the chronology in sequence and assume that everything happened in the order that it's presented. And then we would have to assume that everybody here was having children at a very quick gestation rate and at a very, very young age. 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, in order for any of this to work. That, of course, is possible, but if so, then it means that any talk of numbers and any talk of chronology is no longer meaningful. Because when you discuss anything of measure, whether it's space, time, with geography, topography, whatever it may be, if we're talking about an entirely different system, then any use of numbers and of measures is meaningless. If you want to talk about a day and say, yes, but then a day was a million years, then using the word a day is no longer meaningful, because I use the word day in order to be able to relate it to my 24-hour time period. If I talk about somebody being a foot high, or 5 feet high, let's say, yes, but then the feet were much bigger, so then 5 feet is really 10 feet, it's no longer meaningful to talk about feet. Because it's only meaningful to use a measure if the measure is a standard that the audience can relate to. So it's one thing if you want to say that in current times, particular measures have been expanded, as we have with the Beitzim in Yerushalayim becoming 5/4 of the size, then that changes certain measures. It's another thing if you say, oh, things were different then. Things were different then to the degree that people were maturing at a rate that we're not familiar with, and people were having children at a time that biologically we today would say is impossible or highly, highly unlikely. So you have that choice. You can go that route, and then you would have to essentially relate to the text as belonging to a different world, a different planet, a different reality than ours. There are many who take that approach. There is something very, very inviting about that approach. But there's something I believe that is also very insidious about that approach, because what it does is it distances the historicity of the Tanakh from anything real. And one of the areas in which we, as observant Jews, have always maintained a fidelity is to the historicity of the text, to the reality of the narrative, to the narrative being grounded in real human beings who really lived on real territory. Indeed, our claim to Eretz Yisrael is very much grounded in the historicity of the text and in the fact that the text is not talking about a different planet and different kinds of people with different kinds of bodies and experiences, but rather about real people who are our ancestors. So there's, of course, another way to go. And the other way to go is to suggest that perhaps the text is not presented in the order in which things happened. Now, I'm not the first to make that suggestion. The Ralbag makes that suggestion exactly on this point, exactly for that reason. He says the story with Yehuda had to have begun years before Yosef was sold, because otherwise there's just no way for all of these events to take place and for Chetzron and Chamul to be born before they go down to Mitzrayim, because people just don't give birth at that young age. Even, by the way, by putting Yehuda earlier, we still have to have these people having children at a relatively young age, as teenagers, but that's certainly within the realm of reason. And so therefore we have to always stop when we get involved in what seems to be a relatively arcane list or something which seems of a trivial nature, to step back and not get lulled into, which often happens, into the sense of tedium when we're reading lists, to say, oh, there's another list of names, let's get past it to the fun stuff. That's very tempting. But on the other hand, great, great messages about how we should be studying Tanakh and how we should be looking at Tanakh can often be buried in what seems to be the most trivial and tedious information, such as a list of names. We take a look at this list, just sit down and do a little bit of the math and realize we have to reevaluate our understanding of the relationship between Yehuda and marrying and having kids and grandchildren and everything else, into the narrative of Yosef. And that, of course, raises the larger question. If indeed Yehuda began his independent life and separated from his family and began his marriage and then his son was bad and was killed, etc., and the whole narrative there, if that indeed began before the story of Yosef, then you have a much larger question, which is why is the Yehuda story placed in the middle of the Yosef narrative instead of where it belongs, which is perhaps at the beginning of Vayeshev? And there are numerous approaches to this, and I'll suggest a couple of them just as a thin, as a thumbnail sketch, and everyone should take it a little bit further on their own. Possibility one is because the end of Parshat Vayishlach, which is a necessary piece, although again it seems tedious, which is the entire list of Alufei Esav, Esav's family, because the Torah will always emphasize the numerous descendants of Avraham. And therefore we're told about Yishmael's descendants, even though they're really of no concern to us here and there later in history, but not in a significant way. We're told also about the bracha that Hashem gave to Avram and to Yitzchak being fulfilled in Esav with the numerous and powerful leaders that he has and his inheritance of Edom. And that is a piece of the puzzle. So we have to end Vayishlach that way. As we see later on, the power person in Yaakov's family is going to be Yosef. So it's very possible that immediately after we hear about Esav and his royal sons and his royal noblemen and his alufim, we have to hear about the rise of our aluf, the aluf of Yaakov's family, which is Yosef, who immediately is given a royal garb, the Ketoret Tapasim, which is worn by royalty. I spoke about this a couple weeks ago. And so we meet our king. So we have to meet Yosef. We have to see the dreams of royalty, the dreams of power. We have to see everything that happens in his life in order to ultimately bring him to power. And then there's, okay, time out. Let's backtrack because there's another segment of the family who is another piece of royalty, which is Yehuda, who we have to start filling in the blanks to show us where that comes from. And then ultimately that'll all come together as Yehuda in the beginning of our parsha will face Yosef, king versus king, in the famous confrontation, which ends, of course, with Yosef famously revealing himself. There is yet another direction to go. And I encourage everyone to take this direction, take the previous direction, take other directions, and try to develop an understanding on why the text would place the Yehuda narrative where it does. And that is that perhaps there is something buried in the Yehuda narrative which serves as something of a commentary on the Yosef narrative. Meaning the Yosef narrative of the dreams and the plot to kill him and then the plot to sell him, whether it was actuated or not, and the deception of Yaakov is something that then plays out again in the Yehuda narrative. Chazal pick up on this in Masechet Sotah, and they point out that Yehuda was evidently the one, they believe, who engineered the deception of Yaakov by sending him the Ketonat HaPasim that was bloody, and saying to him, recognize, see if this is Hakerna, if this is the garment of your son. And of course, Yaakov believes that it is, and believes that Yosef is dead. And it is the same Yehuda who had that idea of deception, who is himself revealed with the same word of Hakerna, when Tamar says to him, see if you can recognize who has this staff and this seal, Hakerna lemia chatemet v'amatev v'aptilim ha'ele. And so the midah keneged midah, the poetic justice, the propriety of the way in which Yehuda is challenged, and by the way, his challenge leads him to greatness, and he becomes perhaps the first real model of a Baal Tshuva that we have in Chumash, in Tanakh, because he recognizes and he says, Tzadka mimeni, that Tamar really is indeed more righteous than I. Is perhaps the reason that the Yehuda story is placed in the middle of the Yosef narrative, but right after Yehuda had engineered the deception of Yaakov. See, this is how he deceived Yaakov, this is how he was exposed. And now we see who Yehuda is, Yehuda sees who Yehuda is, and from here on in, Yehuda acts as he should, responsibly taking the leadership of the family and ultimately challenging Tzafnat Paneach, the regent of Egypt, who he does not know as Yosef, and ultimately leading to the glorious reunion with his brothers and with his father, who he had missed for all of these 22 years. Everyone should have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos.